Good morning, everybody. This meeting is being recorded. It is 9:02 on Monday, April 1st. Ms. Hiller, after you call the meeting to order, we'll do a roll call of the committee members and staff to make sure.
Which I will do right now. So I hereby call this committee meeting to order.
Fantastic. This is Tuesday, April 1st, the committee meeting. Ms. Hiller.
Present.
Dr. Bastillo.
Yeah. Here.
Mr. Leone.
Here.
Ms. Sell. Dr. Bordenave.
Here.
Dr. Linsky.
Here.
Mr. Packard.
Here.
Dr. Toon.
Here.
Ms. Viron.
Ms. Viron is on an airplane heading home today. When I spoke with her, I guess I could wait till the next agenda item about Helene. So we'll come back to Helene.
For the record, I'm just going to note the absences as Helene Fearon and JJ Purcell. Ms. Hiller, the meeting is yours.
Oh, goody. Well, now I guess I can make the announcement. I'll wait until the item about Helene. First of all, we have two sets of minutes to review. They were posted on our shared drive. I would first ask for a move to adopt the minutes from our virtual meeting on January 30th, 2024. Do I hear a second?
Second.
Karen. So any discussion, any corrections, changes to the minutes that you saw as posted? Hearing none, I'll go ahead and call the question.
It's been moved by Ms. Hiller and seconded by Dr. DiPio to approve the January 30th, 2024 Rules Committee minutes.
Judy, we're here. We're here.
Yes, there is.
It's Karen. It's coming through Karen.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll read that motion again. It's been moved by Ms. Hiller and seconded by Dr. Bastillo to approve the January 30th, 2024 Rules Committee minutes. Ms. Hiller?
Yes.
Dr. Bastillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Purcell is absent. Dr. Bordenave?
Yes.
Dr. Linsky?
Yes.
Mr. Packard?
Yes.
Dr. Toon?
Yes.
Ms. Fearon is absent. My apologies. That motion passes.
Next agenda item, I would move to adopt the minutes from our February 12th meeting as posted in our shared folder. Do I have a second?
I second.
Thank you, Dr. Toon. As they were posted with editorial corrections from Ms. Chepius, to the minutes and reposted. Any comments or discussions about the minutes from February 12th?
There's one item that's incorrect on there, number six, on the chart showing what all of us were working on. Mr. Packard should be at number six as well.
Judy, is it okay to take that at this time? We do have that as an agenda item.
Yeah, that was based on the audio from the meeting last time. His name wasn't added, so we've agendized for discussion this time around to add his name back into that group.
Okay.
But thank you for catching that, Giovanni. We're on that one.
Cool.
So let me just ask the question. That puts me on five different groups. Is that too many for me to be involved with? I'm happy to surrender a position to someone else.
For right now, let's put you back on six, okay? Maybe there are others where you're less needed. Maybe you have other choices.
I'm fine to work on them. I'm just, I don't want to, you know, fog the role. So I know you have to find places for Helene as well. And
that is correct.
I'm happy to step aside for Helene, any place you want to use her.
That would be fine, Blair, if you want to not add your name to six. I mean, I think it's kind of important to have someone with some experience on six. Giovanni does as a PT assistant. JJ, I'm not sure his depth of experience, but that could be something that Helene would be happy to step in on. But I mean, I'm happy to keep you there or take you off, Blair. That's your call.
Well, let's leave it there for now. I'm happy to contribute.
Okay.
Okay, well, we have a motion and a second on the table for the February 12th, 2024 meeting minutes. Are you ready for that vote?
Yes.
Thank you. So it's been moved by Ms. Hiller and seconded by Dr. Toon to approve the February 12th, 2024 Rules Committee minutes. Ms. Hiller?
Yes.
Dr. Bastia?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Bordenave? She's muted.
Yes. Oh, there she is. I tried some other way to unmute myself and it didn't work.
I'm sorry. What did you vote on that one?
Yes.
Thank you. Dr. Linsky?
Yes.
Mr. Packard?
Yes.
Dr. Toon?
Yes.
And Ms. Fearon is absent. That motion has passed.
Next agenda item that we take is to welcoming Helene Fearon, who's not here to be welcomed. I spoke with her at length. She's happy to join the group. She's on a flight home, but when we got all of our committee who were available to meet today, except for her, she said, absolutely. Go for the meeting. She'll listen to the recording. And based on our discussions today, she will go ahead and select those topics that most interest her or where we feel her expertise and experience would be helpful. So she will reconnect by the end of the week and come up with her assignments, and then I will redistribute the list of tasks. So she's happy to join the group, flattered to be invited, and we'll be glad to embrace her when she's available. I don't think there's any action that we need to take on this because it's a board appointment.
Correct.
Okay, let's get down to the nitty-gritty. That takes us to agenda item five. Whoop, correction to the research tasks, which had to do with Blair's name falling off the list as far as task six is concerned. I'll remind you, task six is looking at supervision of PT assistants and PT aides. And so, you know, we've had some discussion about it when we talked about the minutes, but I would at this point like to put Blair back in that task group until such time as we see how things are falling together. Discussion? Oh, I guess I have to move that. I would move to appoint Blair to task six, supervision of PT assistants and aides, AIDES. Do I have a second?
Sure.
One second.
Discussion, we've actually had it, but I'll open it up once again for discussion. And Mr. Packard, you're happy to continue serving on task six at the present time. You're on mute.
Yes. I don't know sign language, so I better undo my mute.
Yeah.
It's helpful. It's helpful with an audio recording.
Any further discussion? Hearing none. I'll call the question.
Okay. It has been moved by Ms. Hiller and seconded by Dr. Bordenave to include Mr. Packard in the research task group six for AAC R4-24-303, supervision of PT assistants and aides. Ms. Hiller?
Yes.
Dr. Bastia?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Bordenave?
Yes.
Dr. Linsky?
Yes.
Mr. Packard?
Yes.
Dr. Toon?
Yes.
That motion passes.
Okie dokie. Now we get to agenda item 6. Now we get to the meat of the motion. Let me compliment the group and talk about how pleased I am that we actually have reporting back on 10 of 12 tasks that we have adopted for ourselves. I think that's pretty awesome that we have managed to move forward on the preponderance of research tasks. I guess I'll start out first by advising the group that when I send out our list of tasks updated with Ms. Farron's name included on several groups, I'm hoping that we can become a little more consistent in how we refer. Sorry about this. I'm all choked up about how well we've done so far. So I will resend it out and make it clear, which is task 5, task 6, task 7, so that we're all speaking the same language. It did take me a little while to sort through your email updates, you know, when you refer to it as R424303. We have a couple of tasks all related to that rule. So I will resend the list out, and it'll be dropped into the folder so that it's very clear, research task 1, research task 2, and we'll be speaking the same language. So what I figured is we'll spend, if we take 5 minutes more or less and go through all 10 tasks that we've been working on and at least brush on the tasks we haven't gotten to and see if we can reformat maybe, you know, one of them I haven't worked on because I just haven't had the time. So no shame in that. It's just let's stay on top of things. Kind of do an update. We have one task that was presented that has been agendized separately for a more detailed discussion and possible adoption by our committee. I'll remind our group that because this is a committee of the board and these are now public sessions, we can really only talk about what has been agendized. So I did get a couple of email updates last Friday, Saturday, reporting on tasks that look like they've been pretty well examined, but we really can't take action on them until we have agendized their discussion. So we will confirm at this meeting or afterwards as your group completes a task and you think it's ready to throw it to the group for discussion and adoption, then we will be able to agendize that at future meetings. Hopefully there won't be too many because we're really chomping away at these tasks. So I guess now we start. I will take task 1, which is JJ and I researching use of the, oh, I'll try to pay attention to time, 9:15, the coursework tool, which in our current rules cites a specific version of the coursework tool for educational equivalency, if you will. And that's the 5th edition. Research through FSBPT, conversations I've had with Leslie Adrian, who is a staff member assigned to the Foreign Educated Physical Therapists, looking at their copious information about use of the coursework tool. We kind of started out thinking, I'm sorry, this is not JJ. This is, who am I working with on coursework?
Working with me.
Oh, that's Lori and I. Is it okay if I went ahead and jumped into this one?
Yeah, it's totally fine. I'll jump in if there's things.
Yeah. Lori and I kind of talked about it. Certainly, FSBPT has adopted some model language for rules. As it relates to the coursework tool, they encourage use of language that allows for the most recent version of the coursework tool, not a dated version. That makes a lot of sense. They also have a number of what they call retro tools, which are coursework tools that were appropriate to earlier years of graduation. They've got, now they're on version 6 and they're working on version 7. So certainly in the model rules from FSBPT, they are encouraging states to allow for use of the retro coursework tool for applicants for endorsement who perhaps had a license elsewhere in another country, come in and apply for a license through endorsement, so they're not planning on retaking the national exam, redoing their educational credentialing.
In another state, Peg.
Say that again, Lori, and go ahead.
Licensed in another state, not another country.
Correct. So we looked at the model language, and it seemed like it was kind of cut and dried, so we amend our language to allow for use of the current coursework tool for current graduates, retro tools for applicants through endorsement. Lori, I'll let you pick it up from here, because then we got it, the fly in the ointment.
Yeah, so we actually had a really lovely discussion. I ended our meeting. I was like, wow, those are the kind of discussions we should be having. So we kind of got hung up on this idea of the retro tools. So for someone who maybe is immigrating and has been licensed and practicing in their home country for many years, why are we suddenly holding them to the most current standard? So why are we evaluating them under coursework tool 7? Let's just say we're going to the new 7. When they've been practicing for a long time, if we had a U.S. trained clinician who had been practicing for a long time in another state, or who hadn't been practicing, wasn't licensed anymore, they were going for initial license, but they got graduated in, oh, let's just use Lori as the example, 1985, would we make them do the most current? We wouldn't evaluate them based on what their education should be now, but what their education was then, and allow them to sit for the licensing exam. So why do we have a different standard for those who are internationally educated or educated at non-CAPTI accredited institutions? Why don't we use the coursework tool that would be appropriate, one of those retro tools based upon the year of graduation? So we had a really good discussion. So I was meant to follow up with states who actually allow that for initial licensure. And I did get some responses back from folks about, have they had issues with this. And I have to tell Peg, and I haven't talked since I started gathering that data, and I haven't looked at it as thoroughly as I want to, but what I thought was interesting is that some of them were like, oh, no, we don't do that, even though on FSBPT that's what it says. And if you read the statute, it looks like that's what they should be doing, but that's not actually what they're doing in practice, it sounds like. But again, I haven't looked at it as thoroughly as I would like to, their responses back. So that was my intention for this week, to be able to get to actually looking through that. But we had a lovely discussion about that, which then prompted us to try and see, are there issues with that? Do they have issues with licensing internationally educated or non-CAPTI accredited schools, those individuals using the retro tool? Have I captured our conversation, Peg?
Yeah, that was a great summary, and that's really where we got. So we weren't, this no-brainer turned into a contemplative exploration of making sure we're not biased against domestically educated applicants who maybe had a gap before applying for Arizona licensure. So to be continued, happy to get feedback from any of you, although we can certainly send something out. But at this point, we're still looking into it, but I think we've made some progress.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It still seems and felt like a no-brainer for us, for those who would be licensed using endorsement through that process. But the question is about initial licensure.
Okay, so moving on, we're going to go to topic research task 2, which has been separately agendized because, I think Blair and Linda have done an awesome job of getting the work done. So I'm going to set task 2 aside, and we'll come back to that. So that takes us to research task 3, which would be Linda and Jim, and that's related to use of the TOEFL.
Yes.
Take it away.
So Linda and I met and did research, and I submitted some of this to Peg and Judy, unfortunately too late to be agendized. So hopefully it'll be agendized for the next meeting. But with regards to the TOEFL, similar to what Lori and Peggy found, is the FSBPT has model rules for PTs trained at non-accredited institutions looking to get licensed in the U.S. And has a whole section on it about what the recommended TOEFL scores are and what the breakdown of those TOEFL scores are as minimums. Arizona is, so the score turns out to be an 89, but then there's specific subsection scores they have to get. Currently, Arizona requires 100. And also the FSBPT did an analysis of all the states, did the research for us. Arizona is one of the highest. And there's actually a bunch of states that don't even require, like Florida does not require English language proficiency, any assessment of it, which I thought was very odd. But our recommendation is to adopt the FSBPT recommendations from their model rules document. Linda, did I capture anything wrong or misrepresent or anything that?
No, I mean, that was certainly a pretty cut and dry, that one.
Were there any states that had problems with citing a specific passing score in the rules, which means you come up and update it periodically? Or did most states include in their rules very specific pass scores?
Linda looked into a couple different states. I went with the FSBPT, but I can pull up. And so the document I sent to Judy and Peggy has the research from the FSBPT on all the different states. Let me pull that up.
Well, it certainly looks like this is work well done, and it sounds like you're ready to present this for discussion and adoption at our next meeting, right?
I think so.
Okie dokie. Circle task. Anything else you wanted to add, Linda? And we have all the material, so that will definitely be posted in advance of our next meeting. Anybody else have any comments or thoughts? Good job.
Thank you.
Okay, that takes us to topic 4. Topic 4 is, oh, that's the one where I didn't have anything submitted. This is the renewal requirements for licensure in the second year of compliance. And it may just be a topic that nobody had time for. That's Jim and Karen. So no worries. That's just why it's not anything you want to say about it?
I think at least initially, I think we were looking more at the continuing competence and that aspect of renewal requirements. We'll look specifically more to see what else is involved in that.
And it actually makes a lot of sense to me to kind of solidify where you would like to see us going for continuing competence, and then that will spill over into that issue of renewal requirements during the short months before a renewal cycle. Okay, so that's four. Sorry, I'm finishing off my notes. Research task five, and that's the therapeutic relationships. That would be Dr. Bustillo. Mr. Packard, are you a doctor? I forget, Blair.
I'm not.
Mr. Packard and Dr. Toon. So, it's research task five. Someone take it away.
So we do have some initial research that has been done. The FSBPT would prefer every state, every jurisdiction to come up with their own definition of what the PT-patient relationship is. They don't have, at least I could not find language that suggested what that might look like. But they do recommend that we look at that. Linda definitely found some different professions that are struggling with the same issues with patient-client relationships. And, I've looked at the Dental and Medical Board in Arizona, and they don't define it either, although they realize that there's some issues. The biggest thing I found so far in this is that the Canadian Physical Therapy Association has defined what the PT-patient relationship is, and they identify that it's 12 months after last date of service. We need to get back together again as a group and come up with something that makes sense for us. But I feel that we probably should try to define this. We're getting more and more and more issues before the board about patient-client relationships. So.
What does APTA have to say about patient-client relationships? Anything?
I did a lot of ethical research with Nancy Kirsch, and again, they want it defined, but they don't give a number. Obviously anything that happens during an episode of care is bad. And, not to be condoned, but there was a little bit of chatter about never having a relationship, but I don't think that that's reasonable either. So, I don't know. They talk about it, but there's no numbers.
Can we have any discussion about this, Peg, or no?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not going to be a two-hour meeting, which is fine. But I think we have time to discuss this. And it's important that we do. This is a big topic.
Yeah, I think this is a really important topic. And the only thing that I would like to make sure that Linda and Karen consider as they're thinking about this is that we have a lot of rural communities in Arizona. And so while there might be some things that feel appropriate if you're living in a metropolitan area, they're not going to feel appropriate if you're living in Winslow or Parker, where you know everybody in your community and you go to dinner with your patients because they're your friends. And so just being thoughtful about how we think about that therapeutic relationship so that we're not constraining rural clinicians in their communities and being part of their communities beyond just being practitioners.
I would absolutely agree with you, Lori. I mean, I don't know if, Peg and Blair remember back in the day. I mean, it was the thing to do. How many physical therapists took a quad home and had relationships with their patients, especially in that neuro rehab setting, happened all the time. And so I don't think it's about going to dinner or those types of things. I think it's, the person going to dinner isn't going to complain. So it's not a problem until there's a complaint, right?
That's a good point, Lori. Appreciate that. And so I can know some rural PTs. If anybody has rural PTs that we could contact just to get their input too is helpful.
You know, one of the things that I think, you know, Karen brought up the issue of you know, the chatter about maybe never. And I think the only thing that might be driving that at all is the fact that, you know, several years ago, we did away with the word discharge in our documentation with the idea that a professional relationship, you know, can be long-term. People do come back on a repeated basis. And so I think that's driving that. But I hear everything that everybody's saying, Lori's comments, other comments in our discussion. And I think we do need to be realistic and look at every situation. So we're going to approach this thoughtfully as we come up with some recommendations for the committee.
Can I add something to the discussion? Sure, I know you know. I would recommend the committee rather than, or the subcommittee, rather than focus on a date, focus on like a code of conduct or something, guidelines for what that post therapy relationship should be. Because I think a date to me feels arbitrary. And we have all these different settings and all these different, you know, rural settings, neuro, all these different things, you know, pediatrics where the, you know, long-term pediatrics where the families become friends. I mean, there's all these different things. And then there is the obviously it's coming in front of the board. There's inappropriate conduct. And we need to have the goal to be a rule that is going to help the board enforce penalties for inappropriate conduct. So I think we need more guidelines about what the conduct is appropriate post, and let that be the guide is my thought about it, but I could be wrong.
Hey, thanks.
As they're talking about inappropriate relationships, we're really talking about sexual relationships, right? Intimacies. We're not talking about friendships, neighborliness. I would have to grab the current rules and see how our current statute to see. I haven't looked at that for a while to see how it's defined as being inappropriate, but, language in other states, are they specific to a sexual relationship with a patient?
Canada was, I believe, very specific. You know, but then there's always, I think Karen brought up, you know, there's issues with money. Money is, yeah, so I like that idea, you know, like what's the conduct? So it's definitely a big subject.
I think that came under the concept of grooming as well, someone who is, you know, working towards, you know, control or a relationship that might be influenced by money or by power or by even verbal abuse. I mean, all those things could be incredible. It isn't necessarily only the sexual, you know, interaction that someone has. There's other factors.
And there was a case before the board this last year, where a family member brought the complaint.
Right.
And it was not a sexual issue. There was other complexities in there. In my understanding, I could be wrong from what so definitely guidelines need to be, you know, it's not just sexual and it's not just money, but those are two of the big ones. Yeah.
I'm thinking this is not going to be a speedy one of the first ones we're going to deal with, but I think these are really rich discussions. Any other avenues that come to mind on the part of the rest of the committee that could be explored? I wish I knew who does it really well. Maybe Canada.
So I think here's the complexity of the issue, Peg. So when some of the ones that are straightforward, FSBT's already put model language out, or some states have some really good language. This one's more, a lot more complex. And if it was easy to come up with a great solution, someone would have, or multiple, we'd be coming back with, oh, so-and-so does it this way, so-and-so does it this way, this is great, this is great. The fact that their research came up with only one place that has some guidelines and the FSBPT hasn't put anything out and the APTA says, yeah, we want something, but we don't know how to do it, just speaks to the issue.
Well, I totally agree with you, Jim. And, you know, I had gone to the code of ethics because I'm like, how is this defined in the code of ethics? And the sexual relationship is easy because it's clearly defined. That's, you just don't do that, right? But where is that line drawn when a client reaches out to you and says, oh, can I be friends with you on Instagram or Facebook or whatever? And maybe you've just finished treating that patient, but you post some, it's your personal account versus your professional account. How do we define those boundaries? In particular, how are those boundaries defined in, you know, maybe you can define that more clearly here, but I find even with students, sometimes I find, where are those boundaries? When can I cross that boundary? And, you know, I've defined for myself what that means, but I don't have any actual guidance that defines that for me. And different faculty define it different ways. So I think the same is true for patients.
Well, the complexity of the issue, even the perplexity of the issue, doesn't limit us from potentially finding a good solution. So I think we need to go forward and see what we can come up with. I think this is a pretty good group of people here, and with the help of the board as well, I think we can find something that would serve our purposes of the public and the board too.
I'm definitely excited at the thought of, excited in an appropriate way, at the thought of maybe providing some clarification for the community and, you know, the public. I think that you would think the psychologists would have really refined the language because their practice so overlaps with emotional and, you know, generational and all kinds of things. But anyway.
I think theirs is, I'm not sure about Arizona. I think New York is like, it's 1 year.
Okay.
After. There's like the date.
I'll check with my two daughters. I have one who's in practice in clinical psychology, clinical counseling, and one who's in school. So I'll check with them.
Good. Task 5, way to go. Research task 6, and this was another one that came in too late to really post or agendize. Giovanni sent copious materials in task 6 is, oh, here's the one where it's Giovanni, JJ, and Blair, newly added Blair.
Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to just gain clarity on, because there's a lot of overlap in some of our tasks relating to this specific rule, the R424303. So are we looking at this from the perspective of that rule related to letter E on there? Is that kind of the one that we're focusing on with this specific task? Because you'll notice that 8 and, or I think it's 7, 8, and 9 also relate to the same rule, just different sections of the rule.
Let me make sure I understand what piece of it are you taking?
Sure. Yeah.
Supervision of students has been teased out. Communication has been teased out for no better reason than they came up as discussion points.
Yeah.
Our January, February meetings. Well, comments? I mean, you ask a fair question, which is, what piece of this are you to be looking at?
And we started looking at it from the perspective of letter E on there, thinking that that's kind of what the group was looking for, which specifies, let me pull my stuff up, before delegating performance of a selected physical therapy intervention or physical therapy task to assist with personnel working on a general or on-site, the supervising therapist shall ensure that the assisted personnel is qualified by education or training to perform the selected physical therapy intervention or physical therapy task in safe, effective, and efficient manner. So that's kind of the one that we were looking at the most, but I just want to make sure we're on the right track with this.
Giovanni, I would say this, which is, I mean, we're not all looking at the same piece of paper. I know the rules language under R424-303, but I think the other issue I see that comes before the board has to do with B2, and that would be on each date of service, the PT shall determine, based on a patient's acuity and treatment plan, whether it is appropriate to use assistive personnel to perform a selective treatment intervention or physical therapy task for the patient. And I think that issue of determining acuity before a PT assistant or other personnel provide services is one that I see come up in any number of complaints. Did you talk to the PT in a home health setting, in a skilled nursing facility? What should be documented? What are the parameters of determining this acuity? Can a practice manager who assigns patients on a schedule to PT assistants be the final voice of whether the patient's acuity is appropriate for that other personnel to provide? I mean, the complexity of determining acuity for each patient on each date of service by the PT. I guess I fold that into the same thing as number E, which is making sure the person you delegate to has the appropriate skills.
Okay. And that makes total sense to me. And we had started looking at that as well, but then I didn't know if there was some overlap that potentially was going to happen with number 8 on our list if we were doing that one as well. So that was kind of the main question that I was running into as well. So if that's the case, we did talk a little bit into that as well.
Okay. Just first of all, let me clarify. I've shared with Giovanni that my month of March was crazy. I wasn't available for much. I was working 5 days a week, long hours, but I'm free April, so I'm going to jump into this a little bit with a little more intensity. But I have one question. Maybe this is for those who have experience with the board and the recent board experience. Are the complaints coming typically against a PT for not taking that responsibility of determining those things, or are they coming against a PTA who has done something? Patient has complained that something has been done by the PTA, and then it's coming, you know, the action is coming to the board towards the PTA. Or is it a combination of both?
I want to say it's probably a combination of both. A lot of times the PTA will be brought to the board for not verifying who their supervising therapist is, for not contacting the therapist to discuss the patients ahead of time. But then there's other situations where the PT is reported to the board for some sort of, you know, action, and we'll determine that, you know, we need to look into that further and bring in the PTA and things like that.
Okay.
The board is also getting complaints from time to time from the PTA wondering, you know, hey, my PT is not doing this, or I don't know who my PTA is, or, you know, there's some of that as well.
Yeah.
And when these complaints go to the point of actionable, you know, determinations by the board, what is the board usually, coming down on the statutes or rules that are being violated?
Substandard care.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And if a complaint comes in and it's, against the PTA, there's several examples of the board then opening a complaint against the PT in the same circumstance, and vice versa. So the PT might come before the board, and it's determined that the PTA was involved as well, but practicing outside of scope, then the board will open that one. There's been a number of complaints that the board has opened as a subsequent complaint because of one direction that they've heard.
So typically you're looking at this as a team issue then. Okay. All right.
Well, and I'll throw this monkey wrench into the discussion. Right now in Arizona, there are two forms of supervision, on site and general. And basically only the PT assistant can work under general supervision. And I know we'll come back to that on the 2000 hour requirement, but now I believe Senate Bill 1267 has passed both the Senate and the House. Is that correct, Jim? Yeah, what's the status of that as it relates to language that is in a current bill before the legislature that definitely impacts language about supervision?
That is in the House, being discussed and being amended. It has passed the Senate, it has passed the House Human Services Committee, and it's in the House. And I'm not sure when it's going to get discussed or voted on. I know amendments to it, because it's an omni bill. It's not just supervision. It hits a bunch of things, and there was some opposition to a few different things in it. But it, on the supervision language, there's still two different levels of supervision on site in general. It just, I think, simplifies things for PTA, specifically PTA supervision, and then definitions of students.
And that PTA supervision has to do with telecommunications?
It's multiple areas.
Okay.
Peg, you weren't at the board's meeting. Was that last week?
Yeah, believe it or not, it was last week.
Oh, my, how time flies. Kayla Black was there as well and had provided to the board. There was one item of language that was misplaced on the amended version that they were looking to correct yet again. And that was that idea of on-site supervision belonged, or excuse me, telehealth, supervision by telehealth belonged in on-site supervision. That has changed to general supervision that can be performed through telehealth.
Okay, good.
So it was removed from that on-site piece into the general piece. Or at least that's underway as far as I'm aware. And hopefully before the House votes on it, that'll be corrected and amended.
Okay. Anything else on topic six? This is a big one.
Yeah, I think the main thing to specify with this that we were looking at was to specifically outline what the guidance would be for PTAs and PT aides. More specific, similar to how the Colorado Practice Act does it, similar to how the Texas Practice Act does it. So that's something that we're going to be looking into, you know, potentially doing where we can outline those a little bit more specific so that there isn't a need for, you know, an abundance of clarity on what people can do. And then in terms of the, you know, determining the patient's acuity and things like that on that day of each visit, something that we were looking at potentially changing the language to is that the PTA would be able to make a determination if there's a change in status that requires the PT to actually have to make that determination on each visit. So, you know, we feel like the PTA should have that ability to make that determination without the PT having to go in every single visit and check that patient chart. But on top of that, another thing that we were potentially looking at adding would be something like similar to the Texas Practice Act, where they have to hold a conference every so many visits or every so many days with the PTA pertaining to that specific patient so that that communication is happening.
Okay. Well, good work to date, and you'll have Blair joining you, so it'll only get more complicated. I say that most lovingly, Blair, as you well know. Anything else we can provide for research task group 6?
Nothing on my end.
Okay. And when we finish this discussion, I'm going to go back and ask the group if there are any groups that specifically would like to have Helene join their group as further insight or work in progress, but we'll get to that when we finish our wrap up. Okay, that takes us to research topic 7, which is specific for supervision of students. And once again, if there's copious materials or some materials that were provided, I think it was too late to get in on this agenda item, and maybe actually you're not quite ready for this, but I would say take it away, either Dr. Bordenave or Dr. Linsky, who'd like to take this one.
Go ahead, Jim.
Sure. So on this, this is the one about the, that our statute, so this is discussing supervision of student physical therapists and student physical therapist assistants. Currently, the definitions for what assistive personnel do not include students, both in the definitions in the statutes and the rules, but in the regulatory language, the students have been put into that category to include them under the supervision ratio, even though that language is not anywhere within the rules or the statutes. What it does say in the rules is that student physical therapists and student physical therapist assistants must be on-site supervised or direct supervision of a PT. So we did a lot of research looking around. This is an issue that's been brought up multiple times. We've done a lot of research into what other states do. And currently, 43 states and territories do not limit the number. Well, the majority, I think, over 43, I forget the number, don't include students as assistive personnel. And then 43 don't limit the number of students that can be supervised. Only 11 actually have any limits at all. And then there's varying degrees. We are one of the most restrictive states on student supervision. And so what Lori and I kind of put together is, and this is part of the SB 1267, is to actually define what a student physical therapist is and what student physical therapist assistant is. And the Model Practice Act does not have a definition. The model rules do not have a definition. So we put together a definition. And then under the rules, and so those definitions could be in the statutes or the rules, because we have definitions in both. It only has to be in one place. It does not have to be in both. And then under supervision and the supervision ratio, we added a line about, again, that they're not assistive personnel and not in the ratio. Now, what ratio is appropriate or what we want to do or anything like that is definitely open for discussion. We know there needs to be supervision of the students, and we know supervision is an issue that comes up in front of the board fairly often. We were tasked in one of the discussions with the board way back when to try to look into other states that don't have supervision ratios for students. Do they have a larger amount of complaints or things like that regarding students? And first of all, I mean, Lori's got better information on this than I do. That research is very hard to, or almost impossible to to carry out. But in what's been done is we have not gotten the states that don't have the caps do not see it as an issue. It is not something that they felt the need to address in their practice act or their rules. That's been overwhelming from the states that don't have the students in the ratios. Lori?
I got nothing to add to that. Jim summarized it very well. Yeah, there was a point in time when we looked to try and find more information. Have there been more complaints with student supervision and those sorts of things? And that information is not, it would be captured potentially in investigations, but that would require asking for that through open records laws to get those, that information. And so it seemed at the time like that was too daunting a task to potentially find nothing that based on conversations, there had not been significant issues with student supervision.
Additionally, one other thing that was came up in some discussions is that the Medicare rules now prohibit, or the Medicare rules limit what or the supervision of a PT over students. So back when, and so this came from Carl DeRosa, back when some of this language came up in our stat or regulatory language, Medicare didn't require direct supervision one-on-one for students working with Medicare patients. Now they do.
They do and they don't. I'm sorry, I missed that.
They used to not require direct supervision of students, right? So you used to be able to treat a Medicare patient, have multiple students treating patients, and or as a therapist, you could be treating one patient and your student could be treating a Medicare patient. That's not allowed anymore, right? If your student's treating a Medicare patient, you cannot be billing for the same time on another patient.
Well, just a technical point of clarification. I always weigh in on this. You won't be paid for when that happens. So when when the Medicare says you can't do that, what they're saying is we're not going to pay you for that. Right. And so there's a difference between, and we sometimes make the leap and the jump between that language and saying, well, it's illegal in the practice acts to do that. It's not. And so I think we need just to be very clear on it. You know, if they find that you are violating that rule and you're making, you know, you're draining the tax revenues into that, they can go ahead and prosecute you for that. But that's different than the licensing board taking action on which.
Yes. Yes, it is. You are correct.
We all like to eat, right, Blair?
That's right.
It sounds to me like topic 7 is perhaps ready to present to the group for. I do have a lot more work to do on it, and of course it's going to be influenced by what happens with 1267, because that would put some of your definitions back in. But are you ready to present this to the group for discussion and adoption at the next meeting?
I think so.
Okay.
Peg, let me just add one more thought as you're wrapping this up, Jim and Lori. You know, one of the challenges that this that came up from this is that in Article 2 in our statutes, 32-2021 is the, you know, persons and activities not required to be licensed. And there's always been a provision in there that PT, that, you know, the students don't have to be licensed while they're under the supervision. And so there's two languages there that seem to create some confusion. Okay, you don't have to license them. The actual language is, a person in a professional education program approved by the board who is satisfied and supervised, blah, 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 you know, doesn't have to be, you know, basically they're not required to be licensed or subject to the requirements for licensure, but it says supervision. So I think your task is defining what that supervision is. I believe that the board's substantive policy statement that was adopted many years ago went a little far and beyond statutory authority when they said, you know, they can't evaluate it. They can't, you know, the PT still has to be the one who makes, you know, the conclusions, the diagnosis or the, and the whole reason that I think this language is put in the first place is because you want a student to be able to have under supervision the right to do everything in a case under supervision. So I think that's what you have to do. You have to define what supervision is. If you relax that ratio, still there's that issue of supervision that is in there.
I think you raise a good point, Blair. I mean, we can't ignore the rest of statute as we look at these.
Right.
Of course, that exemption is finite in time, in the same way that an exemption for someone who is a therapist who is visiting with a team who is in the state for less than 60 days is exempted from needing a license. So that exemption you're referring to is in some cases talking about finite dimension. Someone isn't a student forever. They're a student for a set amount of time. So that exemption, you know, was meant to have a clock ticking, but I think it has to be considered. So it's a point well taken.
So Blair, would you define that in the rules in that same section in that R424-303? Would you, if you're going to say that they're not assistive personnel, do you think there should be language about the type of supervision that's required for students?
Yes, and I think you're right. I think you're going right down the right pathway there. I don't believe assistive personnel is a matter of our statute, licensure standards or structure. And so I think we've said here that they don't have to be licensed, but we're doing that now under this statute, under this rule, rather, that you're putting them under the ratio. But you still have to come back to supervision. So that is where you have to define what that supervision is and place restrictions that protect the public in that language.
You could potentially put that language under R424-303C.
Mm-hmm. I don't have that in front of me right now, so I can pull that
out.
Ratios.
And just have something that's specific to students in there.
Well, no, it's not. There's not supposed to. It's because students are defined as assistive personnel. So if we remove students out of assistive personnel, if we define them as not being part of that, then we probably need another subsection because C is about supervision ratios for assistive personnel. So students aren't assistive personnel and they're a separate category, then they probably need their own letter.
Yeah.
Bullet. Whatever.
And there's two, and Mr. Packard, I don't know which of the substantive policy statements you were referring to, but there's two of them addressing supervision, and one of them is specific to graduates not yet licensed. So they are graduated students, not any longer in the confines of a clinical education, but they are waiting to take their exams or they have not been successful on their exams and are continuing. Current structure then identifies those individuals as basically an aide is how they would be functioning because they're no longer under the purview of their school. They are under purely practice, at which point, you know, they've got the more education, they've got that information so they can be utilized in those fashions, but there's still going to be a lot of structural issues. And we have a lot of students in that realm.
Graduates.
Graduates, yes. Graduates are different than the
students. Yeah, we've defined students as being enrolled in a CAPTI accredited program. So once they graduate, they're no longer enrolled. And so that's a whole different bird.
Mm-hmm. I think the policy statement I was referring to, I think it was the other one. So
yeah, mm-hmm. That's the one that we that defines students as assistive personnel, the other policy statement. Yeah.
Yeah.
Judy, based on the number of people who fall into that category of graduates not yet licensed, do you think that maybe requires some attention as we look at this whole supervision smorgasbord?
Not necessarily, because the fact of the matter is the board doesn't have any regulation over them. And the school no longer has any for lack of a better word, power over them. Mm-hmm. So I think when they're graduates still waiting, because we don't have a mechanism that does temporary licenses or anything. And frankly, that window is sometimes so short that it would be a huge administrative burden to suddenly start doing that. So I don't know that the rules can address something that they don't truly have regulation over. However, if they are an aide, then they fall under the supervision structure of the PT, and the PT can then be held accountable. So I think that's, in my humble opinion, I think that piece of it is fine.
Yeah.
Because again, there's going to be those outliers that may take a couple of years to get through those exam cycles, but those are not the norm.
I fully agree with Judy on that for most of them, we don't have anything. The only question, we don't need to do anything. It's handled, and as far as I know, we're not getting complaints. The only complaint I hear is sometimes about the time frame from submitting that initial application to the time it gets approved, especially if it's coming from another state or something like that. So I don't know. I don't think that's anything rules related, but I didn't know if that's something of a discussion at the board level. But I don't think that's for us here. I don't think there needs to be any rules about it, but I know, I've heard from some students that the delay has been a lot longer than they've expected for some reason or another.
Okay, well, it's certainly bred some good discussions. You do feel you'll be ready at the next meeting to maybe present this for a final review and adoption. That takes us to task 8. Which I will tell you, JJ has done some work on. He's not here to defend himself or even to present his work about documentation of communication. I haven't had any time to work on it, so definitely not forward progress. But JJ and I will connect on this one, and I'm thinking probably draw Helene into this one, because I think it's kind of a biggie. How often do we wring our hands and say, if only you had documented that you had that discussion, then the board would have no question, but that it was an appropriate decision that was made. So, you know, I think this is pretty meaty. I don't have progress to report because I didn't even realize JJ was working on it until I got his email. So any guidance that anybody wants to throw out there now? Anybody who has thoughts about it?
I think this relates back to the one that we're working on number 6 as well, in terms of determining the acuity of the patient. So I know when I spoke with JJ on this yesterday, he said he's probably going to be using some of that information for this specific line item as well.
Well, that's great, because the more help we have, the better. And as I said, I think that's a good one for Helene to jump in on, because you know, she certainly knows about that aspect. So I would just say research task 8 is a work in progress. He did make one suggestion, which was, because 8 is so dependent on what's happening in both 6 and 7, that maybe we need to see how things are shaping up with 6 and 7 to kind of see where we want to go with 8. So there's good reason to hold this one aside for now. Anybody who's got strong feelings about it is welcome to reach out to me and let me know how you feel, and I will talk to Helene about joining our group. Research task 9 supervision ratios. Do I have anything about 9?
No, I think that's Blair and I, and we haven't, okay. been really communicating with each other, if I'm honest, because I think we've both been crazy busy.
And also, you know, this will depend on what happens in the state legislature. You know, this is something that we can, I'm happy to sit back and kind of wait and see if that bill goes somewhere, or if it dies, and if it goes somewhere, then we have to revise this, and this will impact this section under supervision considerably.
But I'm curious how, and I know it's there on FSBPT, how many states do include some numeric ratio of PTs to other people?
I think, Jim, you have that information, don't you?
I have to go back and look into my research.
I know it's there on FSBPT, so I know it's a topic we'll be talking more about.
Yes.
And when we drafted the Model Practice Act and then the guideline, or the broad guidelines for rules, it says basically that there should be a ratio, but it doesn't specify what it is.
And I was certainly present on the board as staff when they dealt with the supervision ratio, and I know just how arbitrary that number 3 was. I mean, it was somewhere between 2 and 4, so they said 3 sounds good. So that is no magic number by any means. So we'll be interested to see how the work proceeds.
Yeah, and there are states that have much bigger ratios, or, you know, 1 to 6 or things like that. So, yeah.
Lori, I'll reach out to you this week. I've got a lot more time this whole month.
Me too.
Okay, that takes us to 9. This was another one that I did not make, although I think maybe I'm misspeaking, Giovanni, that on number 10. And who are you working with on number 10?
Working with JJ.
Oh yeah, JJ. I'm not sure how close you are, so I'll turn it over to you. Tell us about Research Task 10.
Yeah, so I mean, I feel like we're pretty much ready to present this at the next meeting. It seems pretty straightforward. We looked into several states or along the Southwest. None of them require any sort of number of hours to participate under general supervision. FSBPT doesn't provide anything in terms of a number of hours to perform under general supervision. So, you know, we were trying to determine, would it be beneficial to still have some sort of number of hours? And honestly, we can't think of any reason why that would be something that needs to be in place. So what we were thinking was just replacing the 2,000 hours with the idea that the PT has to make a determination on whether the PTA has adequate training to provide all interventions and therapy tasks that they're delegated, and just let it be up to the PT what the PTA can perform and whether they can perform under general or direct supervision.
I guess I'll be a voice for the contrary view, which is general supervision means there is no one there with you.
Yes.
Yeah, maybe you could talk to them on a phone, right? Maybe yeah. You decide that you've gotten a PTA has gotten over their head and say, you know what, I think you maybe need to check this patient out. But, you know, I think the reason for instilling a certain amount of on-the-job experience, not in-school experience, but on the job, was that general supervision meant you were far more on your own than if a therapist was in the building or in the facility. So, you know, I'm not standing, you know, I'm not falling on my petard, whatever the heck that means, about the need for some on-the-job experience before a PT assistant, who isn't a PT. They have a lot of education, but they're not, you know, the same as, could work more independently, and whether that might require some job experience. So I'm just throwing that out there to say, I know why it was put in there in the beginning, was to give a little maturity and experience to a PT assistant who wouldn't have a PT readily available.
Yeah. And I can completely understand that. And again, if we had seen more proof of this being the standard across multiple states that we were looking into, as well as FSBPT, I think we would probably be more apt to put some sort of a restriction in there. I'm just not seeing any proof that that is going to make or break what's going on with the PTA, you know, being under general supervision.
Well, and certainly for board members, I suppose we could look at the kind of the history of complaints and see if there are very many complaints that arise from, you know, an inexperienced PTA, but then we haven't had any because of the 2,000-hour requirement. How much of an administrative nightmare is that, Judy?
That's not something that is handled by the board or staff. That's something that's handled by the employer and the PT.
Yeah.
I think our biggest issue becomes not in a clinic setting or even a facility setting. It's really skilled nursing and home health. That's where we're seeing the biggest problem with administration telling the physical therapist that they have to work with X, Y, and Z PTA with these, and they're the ones that are scheduling the PTA for a caseload. And so then the therapist is not really ensuring that the PTA has the requisite skill set to work with that particular patient. I don't know that 2,000 hours ensures that by any means. So I appreciate the thought process here. But it does put a lot more onus on that physical therapist to ensure that the people that they're supervising do have the skill set that they need.
And just, I know in skilled nursing and certain, and home health, certain areas in Arizona, for sure. And it's just a thought, not like I have anything more to say than we have a lot of travelers and then their rules are different in every state, and not saying again that I'm against this 2,000 hour, you know, either for or against, but thinking of travelers. And anyway.
I can add that the APTA Arizona supports the removal of the 2,000 hours.
You think that's a topic that needs a lot more time? I'm not trying to push anybody into early adoption. I just want to make sure we're moving things along so that, you know, we can take action. You think that 2,000 hours is something that you want to languish for a while? Or you think maybe we're ready to roll on that one with a little additional, you know, work on it?
I think that we're ready to roll on it with, you know, possibly just putting in some additional language, you know, as protection, obviously. I think it's probably a good idea to add some sort of language. As I mentioned, you know, making sure that the PTA has the adequate training to perform any tasks that have been delegated, but maybe it's even going as far as that the PT has to make that decision at the initial evaluation that patient is actually appropriate for the PTA to see from that point. You know, the management team of an organization isn't going to be able to make that decision. So if it's in statute that the PT has to be making that decision, then, you know, they can put processes in place, I would hope, to make sure that they know what PTAs can see what patients.
Where does acuity factor into that?
What's that?
Where does acuity factor into that? You know, you do the evaluation. You know, it's a patient that ideally will perform in a fairly expected manner, and yet they don't.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to what we were talking about on number six, is that the PTA should have some ability to make that determination on whether the acuity has changed for that patient, and should know, because I'm seeing that there's some sort of a status change, I need to make sure that I get with the supervising therapist you know, get that response within 15 minutes, make sure the PT comes and sees what's going on with the patient if it's deemed necessary, whatever the case might be. So that, again, it's kind of one of those things where I think a lot of these fit and overlap with each other. So the language on one of these rules is going to affect the language on the other rules as well.
Right. Although I think for 2,000 hours, that was such an arbitrary number anyway.
Yeah.
That is kind of a smaller piece of it that could be resolved while we're waiting for the big pieces to fall into place.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything else on research task 10?
Giovanni, there's language that the APTAZ kind of put together on it. Did you get that language?
I didn't. I wasn't aware that the APTA had been discussing that, but I would love to get that language if you have it.
Yeah, I'll send you what. And that came from the PTA directors.
Okay, awesome.
Cool. Perfect. Okay. Next up, numerically, would be research task 11, discharge summary, which also was one, let's see. Oh, that's Blair and I. It's been so long. Blair, I'll let you take this one since I'm confounded.
We found there's a lot of language in APTA's positions and policies, particularly the standards of practice. But as we talked about this, we weren't sure that the language was specific enough or useful enough for the standards or the rules. And so I'm not sure we can't go back and massage or extract some concepts from that that might be useful. So I'm still looking at that. But again, our task is to, you know, find out, the specific requirements necessary in a discharge summary. We had a discussion about the difference in, you know, how software, the electronic health record software, you know, provides kind of two options. You have a complete discharge summary when you discharge a patient on the day of the last treatment session. But a lot of patients don't fall into that situation. You know, they cancel the last appointment. You put them on a hold for a couple of weeks to see how they're doing, and they call back and say, we're doing fine. You have a phone consult. And so then what you do is called a quick discharge summary. And so, as I went through the elements in a quick discharge summary, which can be done in a paragraph, Peggy quickly pointed out that, well, those meet rules. Basically, those meet the rules. So I think it's a matter of just being clear and making sure that our rule language is clear as far as what constitutes the elements of a discharge summary. And so we're working on that.
And our question for the committee was, when we came up with this topic, when we were discussing the rules, Article 1, 2, 3, 4, and what needed to be looked at, and this was put on the table, was there anybody in the group who had issues with the current language for a discharge summary? We were kind of trying to backtrack and see, well, what is an adequate in our current rules to describe what should be included in the discharge summary? When does the discharge happen? At the conclusion of an episode of care, or at the conclusion of the patient's life, or times in between? So
I think the only issue I've ever had with the discharge summary rule is that we get a lot of therapists that are not sure what should technically be going into it if the patient falls off the schedule. So, you know, as of right now, just to be on the safe side, what we have a bunch of our therapists do is still write out a discharge summary as if the patient showed up to care, but designating that they didn't show up to care that day. So there's no billing or anything like that that's associated with it, but they can update their subjective, their assessment, their goals, all of that kind of stuff. And then there's another group of therapists who believe that, well, I should only have to do like an administrative discharge, which a lot of those systems tend to have. So I just think that it would be great to have a little more clarity on if a patient all of a sudden ends their care, you know, and they're a self-discharge, what specifically needs to be done in a discharge summary? Does it need to be a full summary? or does it, can it just be an administrative discharge with the previous note hosting the contents of their last visit?
I know. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Linda.
You know, I know in my setting, we have our patients aren't discharged. They are from PT, but, you know, they're CRS patients. I have it in my evaluation, like in the plan, that they're not directly discharged from the facility. And a lot of people just drop off and we can't get a hold of the parents, even though we know they're going to come back. I've just taken the discharge, what's required from our practice act, and that becomes my discharge summary. And I use it as episode of care. I use that language specifically because they're not discharged from the facility. I just will say that episode of care because I know they may be back for a piece of equipment. They may have transportation again. Who knows? You know, there's lots of reasons they may come back.
Yeah, I was going to say that to me is where the potential challenge lies, right? You know, in pediatric PT, sometimes you're seeing a patient over their lifetime. And so what is meant by an episode of care, even in that frame? So, you know, is it just because you're taking a pause from direct intervention? That's an end of an episode of care. But sometimes you still have contact with that family member for, you know, oh, hey, by the way, question. So how does that then get documented? Is that another an assessment? So I think therein lies some of the challenges with those types of relationships. And you see that in places like assisted living facilities as well. So maybe it falls mostly on those ends of life spectrum. I don't know, but.
Yeah, Peg and I discussed this as well. You know, the default language in APTA language is not discharge. That word has been removed from APTA language, and it is episode of care. So you're focused on episode of care, but again, the question that I think the board might struggle with is again what you've raised. When do you stop an episode of care versus you know, and having to need what the statutes or rules require as a discharge summary? So, you know, we can put this on our list of potential language updates for future revisions of the Practice Act too. If we want to move away from discharge to episode of care, that'll have to be done. But I think we have to work within the confines now of, you know, statute language, and it does define a discharge summary. So we'll be constrained somewhat by that.
I have a question and the necessity of a discharge summary. Does that protect the public? Maybe not appropriate for this discussion then.
No. That's a good question. I mean, why are we doing this? Is it really about the patient, or is it more about our liability? Is it more about?
This does always seem like another onerous documentation task to me.
Yeah, it's a valid question. I think, you know, are we doing a discharge summary because it's what's best for the patient? You know, especially if they fall off the schedule or if they're somebody who continues to come in over a long period of time, or are we doing it to clean out our EMR? You know, there's, I think it's a good
point. Or are you doing it to be paid?
Are we doing it to be paid? But at the same time, you know, we still get paid for our visits even without a discharge summary being done.
Well, certainly the national standards for documentation, that's the paperwork side of it, are pretty consistent in APTA, FSBPT. I mean, they're pretty consistent in wanting some kind of a written record of the conclusion of patient visits, even if they restart again. Now, maybe that's just because I said so, you know, because they say it's the best thing to do, then that's what we should be doing. I don't know. I mean, I would have said, I mean, these are kind of substantive questions that are being asked. I know, Linda, you kind of set off a bomb here. which is good. Which is good. I'm not sure where to look for better research or substantiation of why we're doing it. I don't know how to answer the question or how to research to get you an answer to the question of, does it benefit the patient if there is discharge documented?
But I think Peggy and I can take that. I think Peggy and I can take that question and.
Oh, we're going to have some fun. I'll have wine, Blair won't, but it'll be fun. Okay, well, and maybe we need to cogitate. I was going to say we might be ready for this next meeting, but we got to give this some more thought, Blair. I'm not going to put it on the table for next meeting. But we'll get back to that, Linda.
I concur.
Anything else on task 11? Okay, that takes us to research task 12. Continuing.
Giovanni, I just sent you a couple emails. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Which is a massive topic, I will say. Who's assigned to 12? Yeah. Dr. Bustillo, Mr. Leone, and Dr. Linsky, all talking about the continuing competence requirements. So you want to give us a short take?
Jim kind of compiled our work for us, so let him discuss it.
All right, let me find it. So we attack this through three different lenses. Let me pull up. I'm trying to find my document. Hey, give me 1 second. Here we are. There we go. Okay. So we hit this with, so the first question we asked when looking at this is 20 hours of CEUs every other year and 10 hours of CEUs for PTA sufficient? And this is a task Karen took on. And we have a report ready to submit to for the next meeting. We just didn't get it done in time for this meeting.
That's good.
But Karen did some research and 20 hours and 10 hours is well below other professions and well below other states. So we have a lot of examples. I mean, CPAs require 80 hours and have an ethics requirement. And I know, Karen, that's near and dear to your heart with your husband, but that's when I saw it. I came right up top. I was like, oh, I know where that came from. Dentists are 64. MDs are 40. And then California has for PTs is 30. Colorado's 30 and 20 for PTAs. So what we kind of came up with after some discussion, New Mexico's 40, includes 12 hours of ethics. So what we kind of came out with reasonable, something we thought, and we'll bring this forward later, is if PTAs become licensed, not certified, as what SB 1267 is putting, then we shouldn't have different standards. We're licensed practitioners of physical therapy. We should have the same standard, and that 30 would be reasonable, and adding an ethics requirement every other year, considering the amount of ethics issues that come in front of the board, seemed appropriate. Texas requires human trafficking, stuff like that. A lot of states require a bunch of different specific things. We thought requiring ethics would be a good step for our state and bumping things to 30 hours. Next, we looked at the for new grads initially licensed, and I have to do some more research. That research is incomplete. I have to do more research into other states, but there's no language around that from the FSBPT. There's also no language from the FSBPT about what a number is out there for anyone. So we kind of put some stuff in there that possibly, so there's no numbers from them. Then we looked at what constitutes activities. And Giovanni did a bunch of research into this, some great research. And every state's different. Ours seem to be pretty complex, maybe overly complex to other states. So Giovanni did a good job of condensing it down into a couple of categories. Categories of it's either approved by some organization or that it is not approved. So other activities, and simplify things down. And we talked about that previously. A lot of this language was put in for the different categories for the faculty in the different programs. And honestly, being a faculty in a program, we don't need all these different categories. We're the people you don't need to worry about. My CEUs are through the roof, and all my faculty CEUs are through the roof. We need to make sure this works for your therapist that's in the clinic 40 plus hours a week. That's what we need to make sure, and that they are getting continued competence. Also, when these original ones were written, things like MedBridge didn't exist. Right? You took correspondence course. There was language in here kind of about correspondence courses. That kind of goes way back, right? Those don't happen anymore.
Pre-COVID.
Yes. Giovanni did a really great job of narrowing things down, and we will present that at the next meeting, in the simplifying the categories of what counts and what doesn't count. And then we did come up with some language, about the new grads. And again, our proposal is that new grads in that year before need to be given, not demonstrate, CEU courses, but that we don't think this will be an administrative burden because it's on them if they get audited, right? So if they get audited, they just need to show in their audit that when they graduated, when they got their initial license, and if it's within a year, then they're okay. So we put the onus, our thought is that we put the onus back onto the therapist there versus the board. I know Judy's not thinking that, but but right now, if you audit me, right, it's on me to demonstrate to you that I have that competence.
Correct. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Miss Committee Chairperson,
yes.
From an administrative perspective, one of the things, since you're still looking at this idea, I would just bring in the administrative piece of it. And yes, that would be the case. If they were a student, they would have to supply that information. But you've got then built into that the students that graduated more than a certain time frame ago, but still are new licenses. You have individuals who come in who did graduate, but they are also licensed elsewhere. So now they're by endorsement for us. So that's different than an examination. So what I do know that a lot of states do is that rather than identifying, if you're a student, you get this. If you're not, you get that. It's a more straight, flat across the board. If you are licensed in this certain period of time, you do not need continuing education. That's something that's going to be, from an administrative perspective, a lot more to track because we have their licensure dates. So before those audits are sent out, we even know if those people should be audited, right? So I would, from a purely administrative perspective, I would suggest maybe identifying what other states are doing. Some of them do it. Some of them have very complex models, like if it's, 3 months, you got to do this. If it's 5 months, you've got to do that. From an administrative perspective, you're either they've graduated or they've been working in another state or to get their license, they had to supply education because they hadn't been licensed. You know, you've got a variety of those circumstances where it might be if you're licensed in that second year, you're not required. If you're licensed at all in that compliance cycle, you're not required until the next one. Those would make it a lot cleaner of a cutoff than just identifying the students. Additionally, we get so many calls on continuing competence, especially in a renewal year and especially when the renewals are in progress. So that is a very compacted 2-month period. So it becomes more difficult to explain to those people. Well, if you were a student, this is the case. If you're a student here, this is the case. If, you know, if you're licensed somewhere else, it might be a different case. A clearly defined, yes, you're required, no, you're not required, is far more manageable.
Well, let me suggest this. And if Task Group 12 hasn't spent time kind of interviewing Judy and talking about the administrative management of continuing competence, then surely I would encourage you to do that separately. If you need to have more discussion and you're not going to be ready for the next meeting, that's okay too. But it sounds like maybe you need to spend a little time finding out from the board administrative perspective what's manageable. So I want to move on because I do want to get to research topic 2.
Can I just do one comment, Peg? So I appreciate the complexity and I'm happy to get rid of it. The one thing that I don't want to lose is that people are getting CE credit for taking students. That's been really impactful in the number of clinical sites that have agreed to take students in the state and the number of clinicians. And so I hope that the group will consider keeping that.
And that is one we are definitely keeping in there just to give peace of mind.
So I don't want to slow things down. I mean, if you think you'll be ready to rock and roll by the next meeting, that's fine. Your call. Right, so, now for the next meeting, ready to present, I have research topic 3 on TOEFL. I have research topic 7 on supervision of students. I have research topic 10 on 2,000-hour requirement. And I have number 12 unless you want me to take it off, but that's okay too. Your call.
So with 12, there's two areas that I would say we're ready to present.
Okay.
That third area, we definitely have to meet with Judy. We definitely have to do some more research. So it might be that we present part of it.
Let's do it that way.
And then part of it the month after.
Perfect. Perfect. Everybody, I mean, Judy, did I write this down correctly? Those are the ones we're talking about, which means we're going to have your materials and they'll be in the folder. You'll have plenty of time to get it in, but those are the ones I'm anticipating we'll go through in greater detail.
I have peg number 3. Sorry, I was taking notes when you mentioned this, so okay. If this is redundant, I apologize. I have number 3, number 7. Number 10.
You got it.
And then potentially portions of number 12.
Yep, that's what I've got.
Okay.
Okay. That segues us to research task number 2, which actually we're ready to discuss. We've got 14 minutes, and I think we can get it done because clearly the time of our next meeting is going to have to be done by, once again, a survey. One more thing before we get off of these other topics. Anybody who's on a topic who specifically, other than the one I requested, would like to add Helene to that topic? Okay, then we'll let her pick. So let's get on to agenda item number 7, research task 2.
Well, I think that one of the reasons why this is ready to present today is Linda and I, you know, we're a good team together. We had similar ideas. Linda, the basic task for this subject was to come up with a definition of current functional status, which is in the rules, but not in statutes, and it's not defined in rules. Linda just clearly asked the question, just like the last question that she asked, is this necessary? And so we spent some time talking about that, and we went back and took a deeper look into statutes and rules and felt that it may not be necessary. So that might be, we might be able to shortcut our task with some rationale for why we would not want to move forward. And it would take some it would take us going back and actually undoing some things. So just some history. We don't know when this phrase was put in rules, functional status, when functional limitation has been a phrase that's in statutes, that is defined, and it's also defined in rules. So at some point in the history of rule development, that phrase was added into rules in Arizona. And that's what I think has caused the challenge in trying to come up with that. So one of the things that we discussed was, well, if you put it in there and we try to define it, does that, number one, we didn't want to create any more administrative work for either the board or clinicians. And so that was one element that drew our, you know, our attention and our focus. The other thing was to, you know, if you come up with some kind of requirement, does it spawn promoting and the continued use of, you know, of outcome measurements, patient developed or patient responded outcome measures, which are core indicators of anything that measures, you know, actual status or progress. And we didn't want to do that either. And so we came back and took a look at the definition of where we find functional limitations in statutes. And it's right within the definition of the practice of physical therapy. And so we look at that and say, well, what the board should be doing, what clinicians should be doing is looking at, do we have good measurable goals in a practice plan, in a plan of care? And as the patient is progressing, are those goals, those functional goals being documented as far as the progress towards those goals? And at the time of discharge, is the discharge include information about whether those functional limitations have changed, has the needle moved because of the intervention? And if we focus on that and perhaps that alone, then we don't need this term of functional status, at the time of whether it's on a day or the end or, you know, discharge summary. If we did what we're all trained to do, develop functional goals, work with the patient with the interventions that focus on those goals, document the progress towards those goals in terms of function. So that's what this report that you have here in the format we proposed, that we defined what our task is. We made some general observations about where this language appears in both rules and statutes. We have some questions for the committee, and one of those questions, let's maybe cover a couple of those right now. One was to go back and say, okay, it's in there now. Functional status is in rules now. How do we get it out of there? Can we make the recommendation in the 2019 rules package and to change that there? Or are we limited by just taking this forward in the 2024 package? So that's our first question. I'll just let Peggy and Judy or anybody else respond to that question first.
Well, I'll respond to that question by saying, it's too late to go back and try to change the 2019 proposed rules. I think that's a done deal. We need to get those finished. And it's something we can so easily address in 2024 that, you know, Judy, I would certainly leave it open to you to further the discussion, but I think we should approach it in 2024, not hindsight 2019.
Right. Well, one of the other components is everything that's set up for 2019 has gone through its processes to date kind of as is. As with any rule, and I caution this committee to understand this, that as with any rule, we won't be able to just make the changes because we've done the research, we've seen the progress, this this is the recommendation the board has adopted. This still has to go through the governor's rules review council, right, who has a history of allowing and or disallowing certain rules, based on whatever parameters they find at that time. So while the 2019 are in progress, there's still got to be some public feedback sessions, things like that about those 2019 rules, but the rules themselves, the setup of what's intended to be changed, I don't think we can change that anymore. But again, it's far from a done deal, simply because it's not under our purview to just finalize it in that fashion. It's got to go through councils. There is also legislation right now that's indicating that not only do rules have to go through council, they also might have to come back and go through the legislature.
Oh my
God. Wow. So we don't really know how that's going to turn out. We don't know how those bills are going to turn out. But at this point, I think we're at a point with the 2019 that we can't change what has been submitted and what has been proposed.
Okay. At this point. That's helpful. So just keep in mind that the term functional status was not proposed to be changed in 2019 in the package. You know, we're just raising that question, could it still be changed? So it's in there. It's been there before 2019. Right. So all we were asked to take a look at is, do we further define it in our rule definitions? And so we're saying, no, we'd rather not do that. We'd rather come back in 2024 and delete the term in the rules. And we give our rationale. We also we added in our report some APTA-related positions that would impact this. And then we make further recommendations in coming back to the whole section of our rules where it refers to adequate patient records. And so we broaden our report, perhaps broadens our task by looking at that whole section. And one of the things that we suggest in there is to get rid of the term medical diagnoses. And that would be a recommendation. It's not something that the Model Practice Act ever intended to do, to try to differentiate between a medical diagnosis and a diagnosis for physical therapy. Somewhere this was added in our rules, and we think it's not in our statutes. So we recommend that this be something for the future to be taken out of there. And so we provided in our document, just some yellow highlighted changes that we would suggest we go forward in the 2024 rules package as we discuss this. So, Linda, what would you add?
I couldn't be any more thorough than you on that, Blair. It's interesting to learn all this, though, as far as we're doing all this and what happens with it in the end. Because I like the proposed changes.
Committee, other comments?
It makes sense to me not to add another term, that if we already have a term, we should just use it throughout.
And the consistency appeals to me. Mm-hmm. And also avoiding trying to explain what functional status is. I mean, basically what you're doing is you're reporting on whether they have deficiencies or not, right?
Right.
Abilities or not. So, I mean, to me, this is like with a single stroke, you can get everything aligned.
You know, like with a lot of the discussion we've had today, there needs to be ongoing clinician education, licensee education. You know, everyone doesn't know these things. Everyone doesn't know how to properly, create measurable goals and track those goals and document those goals. And, you know, I'm not sure if that's the board's responsibility. I think, but every licensee needs to be aware of what's in those statutes. I totally concur, Jim, with your recommendation to add some ethics requirements in our relicensure things to make us more focused on what does our law tell us that we should be doing, and bring that back to the attention of those who are regulated on a, you know, every other year basis.
There are also states that require jurisprudence exams. on a repetitive basis. Every other, I'm not saying that's a better answer than ethics education, but certainly I think there are many states that recognize that you can lead, you know, if you don't have any enforcement in getting people to know what their law says, then require it every couple of renewals. You have to go back through the statute. So.
We thought about that, honestly, but it'll be easier if we have a jam instead of a jurisprudence examination to do. We were going to do an either or ethics or the law, the AZ law, but from an administrative standpoint, we can't do that. So if we do go to that jam model, we could do that maybe for the next time.
Yeah. Anything else? I think we're fine, Peggy, with the presentation we have, and we'll leave it with the committee to decide whether it moves forward.
Now, keeping in mind that if the committee votes to adopt this as a recommendation we're going to put forward, that is the first baby step. It doesn't mean it, of course, you all know, but this is just the first step in what we will present back to the board when they open up the 2024 rulemaking process. As recommendations from the committee. So I guess I would entertain a motion to adopt the recommendations of task group number 2 as presented in amending language in R-424-304 adequate patient records to address function.
I'll make a motion, Judy.
Okay, so to make the motion, we need it sort of encapsulated in what it is that you're recommending to the board.
I thought Peggy just said that.
Well, quoting the rules is the easy part.
I move that we accept the recommendations from the task force or group working on R-424-304 adequate patient records. Does that work, Judy?
It does. We're going to probably refine that just a little bit.
Let's say adopt, because that means we're kind of standing behind it, if we might.
Absolutely.
Judy, did you get a second? If not, I'll second it. Am I allowed?
We haven't gotten a second yet, so okay, so that's good. Dr. Bordenave and Ms. Hiller. Now, move to adopt the recommendations from task group 2 regarding article 1. The definition of function as it relates to functional status, and then perhaps a very encapsulated summary of what that recommendation is to include in this motion, if that's okay with the motion maker and the second.
It's okay with me.
Okay. And perhaps Mr. Packard can give us a brief overarching encapsulation for the purposes of a motion.
To not further define functional status, but rely on existing statute and rule language and definitions regarding functional limitations. And I would say to further look at the R-424-304 adequate patient records to also delete the term medical from medical diagnoses.
And B2.
Okay.
So to strike medical in front of diagnosis.
Okay, so medical diagnosis is in R4, 24.
304, 2. I'm sorry, 304B2. So that it reads the patient's relevant diagnoses or conditions.
Okay. Okay, so then moved by Dr. Bordenave and seconded by Ms. Hiller. Both of you, I assume, are okay with that friendly amendment to your motion? Okay.
Yes.
To adopt recommendations from task group 2 regarding article 1, R4-24-101, definitions of function as it relates to functional status, to not further define status, but to rely on existing statute and rules regarding functional limitations, and to consider medical diagnosis from R4-24-304B for further future action.
Works for us, I think.
Yep.
Perfect. Okay. That is your motion, Ms. Hiller.
Yep.
Dr. Bastillo.
Yes.
Mr. Leone. You're muted, Mr. Leone.
Yes.
Dr. Bordenave.
Yes.
Dr. Linsky.
Yes. Sorry, I have to jump to another meeting.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, Jim, send out a survey for the next meeting.
Mr. Packard?
Yes.
Dr. Toon?
Yes.
And Ms. Fearon. Okay, that motion passes.
Woo-hoo!
Okay, and the record is going to reflect that Mr. Linsky exited the meeting at 11:04.
And that takes
us. Dr. Linsky. Go ahead, Peg.
I was just going to say that kind of completes the work from today. There's still work ahead. This awesome group. Thank you. Thank you all. I would say that concludes our meeting today. We will once again need to come up with a meeting date by survey. This is April 1st. I'm guessing we're talking sometime in the latter part of May before people start summer vacations. So we'll probably send out a survey to see what your availability is in those last 2 weeks of May.
Okay.
I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
Hold that thought. We have to make a motion on this one first.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, so do we have a motion to schedule the next committee meeting by in May by submitting a poll?
I move that.
Okay.
Second.
Bordenave and Dr. Bastillo, fantastic. So it was moved by Dr. Bordenave and seconded by Dr. Bastillo to schedule the next committee meeting in May by process of member poll. Ms. Hiller?
Yes.
Dr. Bastillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Bordenave?
Yes.
Dr. Linsky is now absent. Mr. Packard?
Yes.
Dr. Toon?
Yes.
That motion passes. Now, because we did not make a motion on the updates section, but in future agenda items, it sounds like you want to agendize the discussion review and possible adoption for task items 3, 7, 10, and 12. So that's in our future agenda items section. Okay. All right.
And now I can entertain a motion for adjournment.
So moved. To adjourn.
Second.
It has been moved and seconded to adjourn. Ms. Hiller?
Yes.
Dr. Bastillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Bordenave?
Yes.
Mr. Packard?
Yes.
Dr. Toon?
Yes.
That motion passes. The meeting is adjourned at 11:06. The recording will stop.
Close. Thank you. Thank you.